Today is Thursday, May 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up.
Well, the main speculation at the moment is on the future of the British Prime Minister, Theresa May.
That's reporter Henry Ridgewell in London. Also ahead, the Pentagon is set to brief the White House today about possibly sending thousands more U.S. troops to the Middle East. And the WHO certifies Algeria and Argentina as malaria-free. It's all on today's International Edition. Top Pentagon officials will provide the president with a wide range of options in response to rising tensions in the Middle East, including possibly sending thousands more U.S. troops to the Middle East. The top U.S. military officer, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, and acting Secretary of Defense, Pat Shanahan, are among the briefers at the White House this afternoon. The request for additional troops has come from U.S. Central Command, said another official, who spoke to VOA on condition of anonymity because plans have not been formalized. It is not clear if the White House will approve sending all or just some of the requested defensive forces, as well as additional Patriot missile batteries and more ships. Last December, Trump announced the withdrawal of 2,000 U.S. troops from Syria. In February, however, he decided to keep about 400 U.S. troops there. Well, for more on this developing story, I spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, who is at the Pentagon.
Top Pentagon officials are providing the president with a wide range of options. This afternoon, it will be in response to the tensions in the Middle East, particularly Iran. One of the options would possibly be sending thousands more U.S. troops to the Middle East, but it's not clear whether that's something that the president is willing to consider. The request for additional troops has come from U.S. Central Command. That's what an official has just told me recently. But that's one of many potential ideas that could work to help put more pressure on Iran, officials say, in order to prevent them from lashing out and carrying out attacks on American forces.
Now, I know that Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan is expected to speak this afternoon on this. So what are the expectations?
Well, we really don't know at this point. I will be trying to ask him a question in just a few minutes to see if he'll talk more on Iran, because for the most part, the Pentagon has been silent. And officials tell me that the Pentagon is trying to be silent because they don't want to get ahead of any decisions that the president makes. None of this is official. These are all options. This is a planning building. They plan for pretty much everything. And as you pointed out, it would be very different for the president to talk about reducing the number of U.S. troops in the region, particularly in Syria. He removed troops earlier and then all of a sudden wanting to add more. So we really have to just wait and see how this meeting goes.
Also, what has been any reaction from Iran on this?
Well, tensions between Tehran and Washington have been escalating since President Donald Trump announced his decision to try to cut Iran's exports to zero. The back and forth has been happening. As you've noticed, the United States has sent in a lot of military might already, an aircraft carrier strike group, another ship, Patriot missile battery. So a lot of things going on there. But we have seen the Iranian government condemn this and saying that the United States is escalating things. But the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps of Iran has said that, you know, if the United States does hit them, they will hit back. So it's very tense right now, and everybody is trying to urge the United States and Iran for calm and caution.
That was VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb at the Pentagon. Well, what looks like Prime Minister Theresa May's final days in office are turning into a drama without much precedence in modern British political history. With lawmakers in her ruling party in open revolt, ministers resigning and more threatening to do so, joining a long list of dozens who've quit in the past 2 years, a teary-eyed May seemed determined today to try to eke out some more time in Downing Street. May refused to meet a trio of top ministers yesterday who were going to tell her either to resign or at the very least to drop the contentious Brexit withdrawal agreement she negotiated with Brussels and which she's trying to get Parliament to approve next month for a fourth time following three previous heavy defeats. Well, I spoke with reporter Henry Ridgewell, who was covering the latest developments in London.
the main speculation at the moment is on the future of the British Prime Minister, Theresa May. She faces another crunch point at the end of this week as members of her own Conservative Party decide whether she should continue as their leader. Of course, she has the ultimate decision on whether to quit or not. And there was an effort made by the party back in December by some MPs to get rid of her then, and that failed. And under normal party rules, the members of parliament would have to wait another year to make another challenge. But what they're trying to do now is change the rules so they can have another go at getting rid of her. That's an indication of the level of frustration in Theresa May's own Conservative Party that they want to get rid of her. They've given her an ultimatum. They say she could quit herself before the end of business tomorrow, that's Friday, but if she doesn't, they have laid votes on whether she should go or not. Currently, those votes are being held in a sealed envelope in one of the committees of the party, and if she doesn't quit, they're going to open that envelope at the end of tomorrow, which will give the backbench MP's verdict on whether Theresa May should continue or not. That's not the final say in the matter, because the rules would then have to be changed to allow them to get rid of Theresa May and launch a new leadership bid.
Is this unusual as Prime Minister for her not to want to resign and want to cling to power?
I think it's partly her nature as a politician, and it's partly the Brexit process itself that is seeing her stay on and cling to power despite the efforts to get rid of her. She's built a reputation as a very tenacious leader, someone who will try to see the job through despite the frustration with her leadership among large parts of the party. And she has become wedded to this idea of getting Brexit completed, of leaving the European Union, or at least getting the legislation to do so passed before she leaves office. But as we've seen over the past weeks and months, getting that legislation through Parliament has proved absolutely impossible. The withdrawal agreement that she signed with Europe, she's brought it to the House of Commons three times to be voted on by lawmakers. Three times they have resoundingly rejected it, twice with record defeats for the government in a major piece of legislation. And yet she's still trying again, and she's pledged to try a fourth time in early June to bring this withdrawal bill back to Parliament to be voted on by MPs. But all the indications are that there aren't more MPs coming on her side. In fact, quite the opposite. More and more MPs, even those who've been loyal in the past, now say they are going to vote against the agreement, that it's the wrong agreement entirely, that it's a hodgepodge of bad ideas that has tried to please everyone, but it's ended up pleasing no one. So it's very difficult to see how she carries on with her current strategy.
What are Brits saying about this?
It's a very divided British public now, and Brexit really has forged these divisions, which are going to be very difficult to get over. A significant proportion of the British public, I think, are sick and tired of Brexit and the debate and how it's paralysed British politics and British society. Just to give you an idea, there have barely been any votes in the Houses of Parliament in recent months just because everything is log-jammed with Brexit. So that's how some people feel. They just want to get it over and done with and move on to something else. Although the truth of it really is that the country is going to be debating and talking to Brussels about the future of the relationship with Europe for many years to come. And then there are many others who just want to leave with no deal at all. They say that's the best possible outcome. We just leave and then we're free to negotiate new trade deals with countries like the United States. And then there's a significant proportion as well who just want to reverse the whole thing, to revoke Brexit, to stay in the European Union. And what we're seeing is a hardening of each of these positions, more polarization on each side, and the middle ground really being hollowed out. And I think we'll see that in the results of the European parliamentary elections. That's happening today in Britain. People are out voting today to choose their next MEPs, a process that wasn't supposed to happen if we had have left the European Union by now. And I think we'll see very poor results for both the main Conservative and Labour parties, and a hardening and a polarization towards other parties on the further left or further right.
That was reporter Henry Ridgewell in London. Among the top stories in the world, Pakistan says it has successfully conducted a training launch of a ballistic missile capable of carrying both nuclear and conventional warheads up to 1,500 kilometers. John Walker Lind, the former jihadi dubbed the American Taliban, was released from prison today after completing 17 years of a 20-year sentence for supporting the Afghan insurgent group. And a rare bipartisan commitment between the White House and Congress to reach a sweeping agreement on infrastructure dramatically collapsed after President Donald Trump threatened to stop working with Democrats on legislation unless they end oversight of his administration. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Well, early results from today's ballot counting of India's massive general election indicate the ruling party of Prime Minister Narendra Modi is on its way to a decisive victory. Although the final results from the 600 million ballots that have to be counted will only be available later in the day. The Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, capturing about 300 seats, while its main rival, the Congress Party, trailed with 50 seats in Parliament around mid-morning. If that number holds, the BJP will have performed even better than in 2014 and will have a commanding majority in Parliament, which has 543 elected seats. Well, this is VOA's International Edition.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Welcome. Return to the streets of Jakarta today after clashes between police and supporters of the losing candidate in Indonesia's presidential election. The government has deployed tens of thousands of police officers to deal with violence that spread over two nights. The violence has left at least seven people dead and more than 200 injured. President Joko Widodo won re-election by defeating former Army General Prabowo Subianto by a margin of 55% to 45%. But Prabowo is planning to challenge the results today in the Constitutional Court. He alleged massive fraud but provided no evidence. Well, increased tariffs to be imposed by the U.S. are expected to have a major impact on many of the products that China sells to the United States. Although the apparel business was not originally on the list of tariffs the U.S. placed on China, it was on the recent list of tariffs that are set to increase up to 25%. China has been the largest exporter of clothing to the United States. Other nations are expected to make efforts to fill the gap left by the higher priced items from China. For more insight into this, VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Marcia Dixon, professor at the Department of Fashion and Apparel Studies at the University of Delaware. She also co-founded the Better Buying Project, which was established to provide a meaningful effort to improve the social responsibility practices in the global apparel industry.
In countries like Bangladesh, Cambodia, apparel exports accounts for vast amounts of their GDP. I think I heard 70-80% in Bangladesh. So it's a huge, huge business. So, you know, they want the business, of course. They want to be producing clothing for the U.S. With my Better Buying initiative, you know, I'm out there talking with suppliers all the time, globally. And we've been hearing for well over 4 years, well before the, you know, the Trump administration and the threats of tariffs to China, we've been hearing from suppliers about the need to move production out of China. And it wasn't simply because, you know, the threat of trade wars, but it was the cost of production. So, you know, there's been a worker shortage and the wages are rising for Chinese workers. And so the Chinese have already been moving production out of China actively since, you know, for at least 4 years. And on the directives of some of their retailer brand customers who are saying, basically, if you don't have factories outside of China, you're not going to get orders from us. And this is in an effort to reduce the costs of production. And so what you see is the Chinese are, you know, the owners of many of the production facilities in Cambodia. In some cases, in Bangladesh. Now, Bangladesh still has a lot of local ownership as well, but the Chinese have been moving production out of China for quite some time.
Is the quality of their apparel as good as is coming from China?
You know, I think the funny thing is when you think about Vietnam and many parts of the world, that the clothing that's produced there is often produced for a parent company that's based in China, in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, or in South Korea. You know, almost all the, if not all of the Cambodian manufacturers are owned by companies outside of China in a big way. And the same with Vietnam. There is Vietnamese ownership as well, but there's an awful lot of Chinese-owned manufacturing there. So, you know, that's that talent of China is being passed on to countries like Vietnam. Interestingly, I think Bangladesh has had a little less foreign investment, but, you know, there are Korean-owned, there are Chinese-owned facilities there. Bangladesh is still known for lower-cost commodity production, but, you know, that's changing. It's just not changing quite fast enough to deal with the tariff situation.
What is this going to do to the safety of garment workers in a place like Bangladesh if they have to greatly expand what they are doing?
And I think, you know, since the Rana Plaza building collapse that killed over 1,100 people, the country has really taken on a huge effort with the support of the branded retailers that purchase from Bangladesh to improve workplace conditions. And you have some beautiful factories in Bangladesh. There's always more to improve. I'll be clear about that. But there has been great strides in worker safety in Bangladesh. Now, if you start thinking about trying to push more production there, you're going to see more of the peaks and valleys across time that really start to get factories and subsequently their workers into risk of non-compliance to codes of conduct related to overtime, related to unauthorized subcontracting, and various things like that, use of temporary labor. So I am worried that as we push too much on Bangladesh, they're going to start feeling what many other parts of the world have in terms of this up and down of production that is really hard to plan for and really hard to accommodate.
That was Marcia Dixon, professor at the Department of Fashion and Apparel Studies at the University of Delaware, speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. Well, the World Health Organization has certified Algeria and Argentina as malaria-free, following 3 consecutive years where no new cases of this deadly disease have been reported. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
It is particularly good news that Algeria, the country where the malaria parasite was discovered in 1880, should be free of this deadly disease, which every year kills more than 400,000 people. Most of the victims are children under age 5 in Africa. The World Health Organization reports Algeria now becomes the second country in Africa to be recognized as malaria-free after Mauritius, which was certified in 1973. And it notes Argentina is the second country in South America after Paraguay to be declared malaria-free. WHO spokeswoman Fadela Shaib tells VOA a combination of many factors has made these achievements possible.
It's very good news for Algeria and Argentina, but also for the two continents and globally also. It means that malaria can be beaten, but the effort should continue because we need also to enhance surveillance to be able to detect if any cases of malaria are still present in the country.
WHO says the two countries eliminated malaria by employing a number of basic, well-proven measures, including insecticide-treated mosquito nets. It says both countries improved surveillance. This enabled them to rapidly rapidly identify and treat every last case of malaria. It says they provided free diagnosis and treatment within their borders. In the case of Argentina, WHO says cross-border collaboration with its neighbor Bolivia was critical in combating malaria. It says both countries teamed up to spray more than 22,000 homes in border areas and to conduct widespread malaria testing. WHO says Algeria's and Argentina's unwavering commitment, perseverance, and success in combating malaria should serve as a model for other countries to put an end to this ancient scourge. Both Algeria and Argentina have succeeded in ridding themselves of the deadly malaria parasite without the benefit of a protective vaccine. Health officials are hopeful this task may become easier in the future with the recent rollout of the first promising malaria vaccine in Ghana and Malawi. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Environmental activists in Italy are increasingly concerned about the impact of plastic waste on marine life and the country's coastline. Their alarms are leading to measures to combat pollution on Italian beaches. Just this week, another whale washed up on the beach in Sicily with plastic waste in its stomach. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA from Rome.
Italy's Environment League, Legambiente, says that every year 8 million tons of waste suffocate beaches and seabeds. Its beach litter report issued this week revealed that its analysis of 93 beaches showed that more than 80% of the waste found was plastic. Once There Was the Sea is the latest initiative organized by Legambiente, which will involve thousands of volunteers in a mass cleanup next weekend on 250 beaches and coastal sites. Legambiente also urged the government this week to approve the Salvamare, Save Our Seas bill that will allow fishermen to bring to shore any plastic that accidentally ends up in their nets without having to pay for disposal costs. Greenpeace Italy sounded its alarm this week when another young sperm whale washed ashore on a Sicilian beach with plastic in its stomach. Giorgia Monti, campaign manager for Greenpeace, said five sperm whales beached in the last 5 months in Italy. She could not confirm whether plastic was the cause of the death of the latest whale found, but said it was very likely and it certainly could not be ignored as a possible factor. Monti added that the sea is sending us a cry of alarm, a desperate SOS. Later this month, Greenpeace is planning to launch a project to monitor plastic pollution levels at sea with a focus on the west coast of Italy. To stem the tide of plastic waste, initiatives have been launched across the country. Among new technology to combat pollution in many Italian ports, new sea bins are now active 24 hours and able to capture more than 1.5 kilograms of plastic a day. Simone Molteni, scientific director of LifeGate, explains how it works. He says it's a filter at water level that is able to clean up to 25,000 liters of seawater per hour, gathering microplastics and fibers. The mechanism is such that fish do not enter these sea bins that are placed in areas where the sea currents lead the waste. In 1 year, they have managed to collect 500,000 tons of plastic. While campaigners say much more needs to be done, some tourist resorts have banned use of non-recyclable plastic and have started to issue stiff fines to anyone found breaking the ban. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
And you've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.